Let's Go Green, sponsored by Airgrid, managing and operating Ireland's electricity grid for a cleaner energy future. Check out airgrid.ie for more.
Hello, and you are very welcome to this week's episode of Let's Go Green here on Midlands 103. I'm your host, Aisling O'Rourke, and I hope you are safe and well as you tune in this week. Well, we have an action-packed show for you lined up. One item I'm particularly excited about this week is a new artistic installation highlighting the need for us to do more to support our biodiversity in Ross Grey. And I'm not going to say any more about it because it's really, really cool. And I want you to hear the conversation later on. So I'm going to leave you guessing for now. But if you're in Ross Grey or if you've been in Ross Grey in the last couple of days and you've seen what I'm talking about, I think you might know. First things first, though, we're joined once again on Let's Go Green by the chairperson of the Climate Advisory Council, Dr. Mary Donnelly. Mary, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you very much indeed. Delighted to be here again.
Now, Mary, you are constantly issuing report cards to the government. I know, to be honest, I don't think anybody appreciates getting any kind of report card. It always brings us back to school, doesn't it?
It does indeed. It does indeed. But what we've done on this occasion is we are now 3 years into a 5-year carbon budget. And it's not looking good for achieving the carbon budget. And really, that's what we wanted to signal, that it's not looking good for the carbon budget. And we really do have to be more thorough, more efficient, faster in the implementation of our activities. On the other hand, and this is really, you know, the good news and the bad news, or bad news and the good news, as the case may be, we did go through a number of the sectors in our press release. And whilst the numbers are not as good as we would like, they're going in the right direction for the most part. And I think it's important to let people know that we are starting to make progress. To some extent, we have turned the ship, not enough, not far enough. But, you know, if you are constantly beating people up and they're not good enough, you know, they'll turn off. So we really felt it was important to come out with the signal that, you know, in some respects, it is going well, we're going in the right direction. So, you know, there is an optimistic element to what we're saying now.
I am constantly reminded of a conversation a friend of mine overheard in the back of her car. She was driving her sons and their friends home from a soccer outing. And they were talking about how in school that day they'd been talking about climate change. And one of them said, quite exasperated, I think about 8 years, maybe 9 years old, "What's the point? The grown-ups caused it all. Earth is burning. There's nothing we can do about it. Why do they bother telling us about it?" And the reason I'm bringing that up now is because it is nice to hear that we have actually started to turn a corner.
I think it's important to say that. And, you know, on the front of our webpage, and we've done this deliberately, we have a little kind of a graphic. If you were born 50 years ago, what's it likely to be when you're 70? And if you're born today, what's it likely to be? What's the more likely to be when you're 70? And I think that's a very illustrative graphic. So at 8 or 9 years of age, he's absolutely right. You know, he will be living through a climate change that we only talk about at this stage. And it's very important that Ireland, and not just Ireland, you know, Europe and the rest of the world, take the actions today to manage the temperature increase. I mean, we used to talk about preventing 1.5. Frankly, we're now looking at trying to prevent 2 degrees, because if we go much beyond that, even the scientists are afraid to look at what it would mean. So I think that the first thing is we've got to take the measures that are necessary to try and prevent the temperature going above 2 degrees. And secondly, and this is becoming very evident now, we have to prepare for the reality of climate change. And mm-hmm. by that I mean the kinds of rain bombs we've seen. You know, look at the floods we've had throughout the country in Middleton and elsewhere. Look at sea level rise. What does that mean? We are an island after all, and the sea level is rising, and we have to take that on board. What does it mean for houses and businesses and infrastructure close to the sea, and will we be able to maintain it? We're getting very stormy storms, if I could say. So we need to be resilient for that. So what's coming to the fore right now is, yes, we need to take action on greenhouse gas emissions to try and control or limit the temperature increase. But at the same time, we also have to prepare for the consequences of climate change, because some of them are already in place and are likely to get worse.
Now, I'm of a generation that has grown up hearing about this. You know, like, I think it kind of, I can remember in the 90s talking about the hole over the ozone layer hole in over Australia. And that's kind of something that sticks out in my mind from primary school. And I say that because we are hearing from a number of industries, perhaps most vocally across Europe from the agriculture sector at the moment, that we're asking too much. We're asking for too much to be done too quickly. But the scientists and yourselves at the Climate Advisory Council are saying, yes, we're making progress, but the progress isn't fast enough. Like, why is it that this is, I feel we've been talking about this for my entire life, and I'm not quite 40, but I'm heading there, you know, but it doesn't feel like the progress. I think it feels like only in the last 5 or 6 years here in Ireland that people are actually making tangible changes that we can feel and notice in our day-to-day lives. How do we bring those other sectors on board who are really feeling the pressure at the moment?
Well, I think, you know, there's a whole range of actions we need to take. But let me just focus on one that is a challenge, but is also an opportunity for Ireland. And that is, as they say in COP, you know, the big international meeting recently, we need to transition away from fossil fuels. I would go further and say that Ireland needs to phase out fossil fuels as quickly as possible. And I say that for a number of reasons. Firstly, of course, that's where our carbon dioxide emissions come from. So clearly, you know, we want to eliminate those. But let's look at where Ireland is in this respect. We import all of our fossil fuels. So it costs us a lot of money to import these. And we do have the opportunity to substitute them with our own homegrown energy, particularly renewable electricity. So just from an economic point of view, it would make sense to use our own rather than to import it. And it would allow us to reduce and ultimately eliminate fossil fuels, which is, you know, 68% of our emissions. And that for me is the number one target. I mean, that's our real focus there. And the areas that we're looking at in that respect are obviously transport, which is, shall we say, the problem area of emissions, but also heating, be it in industry and in our own homes, because we have a very high share of using oil for heating in Ireland. So the question really for us is what are the policy tools, what are the instruments, what are the supports that we need to put in place that will allow people to move away from using the fossil fuels and use the sustainable energy instead? So that's a real target for the council. And that's one of the areas that we're pointing to in the release that we've made.
You know, I talk a lot in my day-to-day life with people about these topics. People are, you know, it's great. They bring it up with me, and I love having the conversations with them. I find it really interesting. But the constant comment that I get, whether it's from my immediate family or listeners to the show, is that I have no problem in doing my bit for the environment. In fact, I want to. However, it has taken me 40 years to get my home to the way it is now today in its nice position. It took 40 years worth of earnings and bit by bit to renovate or whatever it might be. I don't have the energy at this stage of my life or the will or the money to go and rip up my plumbing system to put in an air to water system or a heat pump. There will be people of a certain age group who listen to this show who are well aware that there's low interest loans available, but they might have hit retirement. They might not be eligible for those loans, or they're heading in that direction and do not want to get into debt because they're finally at the end of the light of the mortgage tunnel. Like, you know, and I think the finance behind this is a real problem for people. Like, ripping up your home is a big ask for anybody, and people do not want to get into even more debt. And okay. That I think is a huge stumbling block that is not being addressed anywhere.
So I think, you know, it is an important thing to break it down across what kind of people have this aspiration on the one hand and problem on the other hand. So, I mean, my first comment to anybody who is, say, late 50s, 60s, who is looking at retirement is, for your own sake, have a warm home. I mean, leaving climate to one side, just have a warm home. Mm-hmm. And depending on what state the home is in, you know, the first thing you need to do is to insulate it, because clearly you don't want to heat the atmosphere. And if you can get your home to a certain stage, moving from oil to, as you say, an air source heat pump is achievable without ripping up the home, because you can just use a little bit more energy, but you'll use a lot more energy before you'll get to the cost of a retrofit. So a full retrofit is not actually necessary to change your heating system. And heating with a heat pump, as you know, it's three times more efficient than the oil boiler is actually cheaper. So you do have a little bit of a capital investment, which you will get a grant aid for, but you don't always have to rip up your home in order to do it. And I think that's the message I would make to people. Firstly, warm your home. That's, I think, logic, common sense. But secondly, look at where you are. You don't have to completely redo the home to go for a heat pump. You can do it. Maybe you might need one extra radiator in a big room, but, you know, radiator is maybe €1,000. And you'll get a grant aid for it. You'll get a grant aid for the heat pump. So I think that, you know, we shouldn't be too hung up on the fact that we all have to gut our houses and start again. First issue, be warm. Second one, decarbonize your heating system with an efficient system that won't cost you as much to run.
Second issue that you brought up there was, and I think that's, I like the response, because it's rare that we get such a clear response for people. So from you know, those in authority. So that's brilliant, Mary. Thank you. But on the transport issue, I think like everyone would love to see Ireland have the public transport infrastructure like they have in Tokyo or Berlin or even London. You know, we'd love not to have to get into the car all the time, but we live in a country where in the urban settings, never mind rural areas, because that's just, it doesn't exist. The public transport system doesn't function. It's not reliable. You cannot plan your day around it if you want to show up on time, an awful lot of the time. And the like, even like if I even take Tullamore as a commuter, if you wanted to go and commute on the train to Dublin back down to Tullamore, and you needed to do a late day's work, the last train down to Tullamore in the evening time, a town of 16,000 people, is 7:15 in the evening. Okay. Yes. And, you know, we don't have the infrastructure there yet. What can the council do to put pressure on the government to, like, there is an awful lot of talk around the demonising of the car driver. There seems to be little actual progress on a decent public transport network.
So the council is pushing very hard on the public transport system from a number of fronts. Firstly, we are pushing the government to decarbonize the transport, you know, to have decarbonized buses, might be hydrogen buses, electric buses, whatever the case may be. We know that they have ordered quite a large number of buses, and they will take delivery of those over the next little while. One of the limiting factors is actually to get drivers for buses. So it's back to the resource issue. As you know, we pretty much have full employment in the country. So getting experienced people who can drive buses is actually proving to be a challenge. But that's one the government has to sort out. That's clearly the case. I think the second issue is to make what we do have work well. And part of the issue there is down to congestion. How do you manage the congestion? Because if you have a bus timetable that says the bus is going to leave at X, and then it gets snarled in traffic down the road, and you're waiting, you know, 20 minutes away, the bus doesn't come. So the extent to which we can free up the space for public transport, give it the priority it deserves, because there's a lot more people in the end of the day, so that the system can be efficient and can run on time and can be accurately tracked through the apps. And, yeah, you know, I've used these apps and I'm not always 100% sure how accurate they are. I think having an app system that really does respond to the reality on the ground is a key issue. But, you know, we also have to address the question of, can people use public transport? And it is true to say that in the urban spaces, it's much easier to use public transport or cycle and walk, as the case may be. if you're living outside of an urban space, you probably have to get into a car to even buy a pint of milk.
Yeah.
Statistic about it. So the issue there is to say, okay, you know, we know you have to have a car, we know you have to have access to the services, but could you plan one trip a week less? That's all. Just one trip a week less. I mean, be realistic about it. Maybe, you know, it means you plan your shopping, or maybe you double up with somebody for going to work one day, or you work at home an extra day. So could you drop just one journey a week? And I think that's how you start. And then people can move on from that. They'll become more aware. So I don't think it's realistic to suggest that, especially if you're living in the rural part of Ireland, that you're going to abandon the car. I don't think that's a realistic. If you have enough money, you can get an electric car and charge it with your solar panels on your roof. That's great. Some people can do that. But I think everybody could say, well, you know, can I drop just one journey a week? And it might be a short journey, it might be a long journey, but that's the opportunity that exists.
I'm very lucky in that I've traveled a lot and I've been privileged to do that. And I've been to Japan and Berlin and London, and I've seen functioning public transport systems that can be relied on, like in Japan, where they apologize if a train is 30 seconds late. And I don't expect you to be able to answer this question, but like, why is it that we have found it so hard to do what other countries have done really well in relation to that?
Well, one of the things that we have been pushing the council has been pushing government on is what we call a demand management strategy. And what do I mean by that? You know, we have roads and we have ring roads. Take the M50, for example. And, you know, people who have to travel on the M50, it's a car park between about 7:30 in the morning and 9:30. And then you can move after that. And then it's another car park between, say, 3:30 and 7. So the question is, could we think about shifting demand outside of those peaks? It's like electricity. You know, you see the ads on TV to beat the peak, put on your washing machine outside of the time slot of 5 to 7, because that's the peak and it's very difficult to cope with the electricity at that time. So could we do the same? Could we think about our infrastructure and spread, you know, even out the demand in some way? And that's down to policy. It's down to policy with regard to when do we start our school times? When do we start our work times? You know, do we think about disincentivizing people using congested infrastructure like, say, the M50 between, as I say, 7:30 and 9:30 by charging them more, for example, so as to spread it out a little bit more. So I think this is part of the policy that we haven't really expanded on in terms of developing new ideas and new supports. And that's one of the areas that the council is really pushing government. Think about demand management. How can you support the spread on our infrastructure? We can't always add another lane to the M50.
Yeah.
We, you know, think about how we can best use that infrastructure.
And the other issue in all of that as well, and I know we don't have time for it today, but as part of that whole conversation and the sector that seems to be completely ignored through these policies are those with mobility difficulties. I live with invisible disability myself. I've had family members that I've cared for who've used wheelchairs or have had mobility issues. And like, you cannot rely on the public transport system working for you in this country if you have a disability, which is quite frankly embarrassing as far as I'm concerned. But that's a whole conversation for another day. Before I let you go, Mary, what is the purpose of these report cards that the Climate Advisory Council issue? Because, you know, we will hear them through the media and listeners will hear them and they'll be discussed on the airwaves for, you know, a period of time. And then maybe 6 months down the line, we get another report from yourselves. And there will be people listening going, oh, here they go again, you know, another slap across the wrist for government. But what's the aim behind them?
Well, it's our job to hold, shall we say, the government to their commitments. We have legislation adopted by our office. We have ambitions, we have targets, we need to achieve them. And if we don't do it, who's going to call government to account? You know, if there isn't somebody there constantly, as you say, report card after report card, constantly with a slap on the wrist, then nothing, I won't say nothing will get done, but it's easy to forget about the objectives that we're trying to achieve. So really, even though there is an element of repetition, and you're absolutely right, there's an element of repetition there, we do have to constantly push this message forward. It's important for our politicians to hear it. It's important for our, you know, structures of, you know, the public sector, civil service, local councils, all to hear the message that, you know, we're watching, we're commenting, we are prepared to acknowledge progress when it is there, but equally, we will call out slackness, slowness, or lack of ambition in actions that are being taken. That's our job.
We started out on a note of hope. As someone who is an expert in this area and has been working on this over a number of years, do you have hope for the future as far as where our progress is?
Actually, if I didn't have hope, I wouldn't be here. I am a glass half full type of person. And I know Ireland, not only can we do it, I think we will be able to show the rest of the world how we've done it. And there's lots of opportunity in that as well. Not only benefits for us, but benefits also for the rest of the world.
Well, Dr. Mary Donnelly, Chair of the Climate Advisory Council, thank you once again for joining us on Let's Go Green here on Midlands 103.
Thank you, Aisling.
We'll be back after the break.
Let's Go Green, sponsored by Airgrid, managing and operating Ireland's electricity grid for a cleaner energy future. Check out airgrid.ie for more.
You're listening to Let's Go Green here on Midlands 103. And something really important happened over the last week. And I'm going to caveat the conversation we're about to have by saying I would love to have more time in the show to delve into this deeper. So in the coming weeks, we will delve into this coming topic deeper. But nature restoration and the rewetting of our bogs. Well, there was a vote in the EU about this, or in Europe about this, in the last couple of days. And to tease it out a little bit with me, we're joined by Caroline O'Doherty, who is the environment correspondent with the Irish Independent. Caroline, this was a very big vote in the last week, wasn't it?
It was, because this is a very, very contentious issue, and most notably the biggest political grouping within the European Parliament takes in the likes of Fine Gael and kind of, you know, Fine Gael type parties from all the other member states voted against it. So that just shows you the weight of power that against it. And it's, you know, because normally they do sort of the mainstream, if you like, votes on things. They normally go with what the commission recommends, but they were opposed to this. So getting it through was a big deal.
Caroline, take me through what happened. What is this item that has caused so much controversy?
So nature restoration, what is it? It literally does what it says on the tin. All of the lands around Europe are in a bad way, essentially. We think even the national parks that are in various countries, they're not in great shape. We have cut them down, dug them up, polluted them, etc. Our rivers are not in good shape. They're dirty. They're dug up. Habitats are suffering. Nature restoration says we need to actually restore our natural landscapes to something akin to what they should be. That's for all our sakes. That's so that there's healthy plants giving out healthy air, taking in CO2, so that we have healthy floodplains that can absorb water and stop flooding in our homes and our towns. It's so that we have wildlife. It's so that we have pollinators, birds and bees, butterflies. It's for all our sakes. If they say if nature isn't working, we're in trouble. Okay, so nature restoration law, what it says is that by 2030, that 20% of all lands across the EU should be restored to their healthy state. And by 2050, all degraded ecosystems. So that's water, coastal, freshwater lands. It's highly ambitious, and yet many will say it doesn't go far enough, because that's going to be, that 20% will be divided up between all the countries. So each of the EU member states now has to go and draw up a nature restoration plan. So it may not be 20% for Ireland, it may be 20% for a different country, or more than 20% for other countries. So we have to do that. It's going to take about 2 years to get all those plans together and then sort of apportion responsibility. And then we're already into the last few years before 2030. So will they hit the 20%? We don't know. There's also another issue in that when this proposal came out first, there was kind of a, if not exactly a compulsory element to it, it certainly was more strongly worded. Land is owned, particularly in Ireland, by farmers.
Yeah.
70% of our land, more in fact, because about 70% is in agriculture, straightforward agriculture, crops and livestock. And then we have about another 12% in forestry, and a lot of that is farmers too. So they own the land. They work the land. And if we want to restore, if we were to restore 20%, even if we were to try to restore 10% by land mass, that encroaches on land that's in use in farming and forestry.
And so, this is why farmers in particular are very concerned about this new law.
Yeah, now you treaded immediately into controversial territory by talking about the re-wetting of bogs there, because they will say it's re-wetting of bogs. As we know, we drained our bogs. We drained them for peat, and we drained them so that to create fields for livestock for grazing. And
in some cases, that draining continues for farmland as well across the country in some parts as well. So this is an ongoing issue.
It is. And the idea is that you stop draining them and you allow them build up again, build up the natural water table. And that stops basically the breakdown of the vegetation in the peatlands, and that holds on to carbon and it starts restoring peatland. Now, peatlands take tens of thousands of years to develop, so we're not going to restore them overnight. But it sort of stops the degradation process, if you like. The Department of Environment will say we're not going to re-wet them because that suggests that they're going to be, you know, as soon as you put your foot on them, you know, water fills your boots, as would be the natural state of many of the boglands, what they should be. They'll say we'll raise the water table. So forget re-wetting, we're raising the water table, which means they say with those fields that they're now fields, they were peatlands, would still be usable for grazing. You know, maybe not year round, maybe not as intensively, maybe for sheep rather than cattle, but they would still be in, they could still be used for farmers. Now, that's hugely controversial because farmers don't believe that. Many of them don't believe that. But the thing about it is the targets, the 20% targets, or say it's 10% for Ireland or 12, whatever it might be, that will be mandatory. So they're saying it won't be mandatory on individual sort of farmers, but the state has to find a way to reach the targets. So the implication of that is that governments will have to find really good incentives to get farmers on board to say, yeah, we're going to take some of your land. We won't take it. That's a controversial word as well. We'll encourage you to change the use of some of your land, but we're going to pay you. So whatever you would have made from that land, be it for crops, be it for livestock, be it whatever, over forestry, potential forestry, future forestry, we'll pay you for that. So you become a custodian, you become a farmer of land restoration and nature restoration rather than a farmer of crops and livestock.
It's interesting. It's a massive topic. We will come back to it at another point on the show to give it justice and to treat it properly. But I suspect, Caroline, that we're going to be talking about this for months to come.
Well, we are, and there's already political fallout from it because we have the five Fine Gael MEPs actually broke ranks with the grouping in the EU and did vote for it, but previously said they'd vote against it. And now there's within Fine Gael, there's anger among some of their own members that they did vote for it. Sinn Féin, for example, voted against it. Now there's anger within the party that they voted against it. So even at political level here, never mind in Europe, there's disgruntlement among some political parties. So if you can't get agreement even within a party, how then do you get agreement on a national plan? And then how do you get that plan to work at local level? It's going to be tricky.
Well, Caroline O'Doherty, environment correspondent with the Irish Independent, thank you very much for joining us on Let's Go Green. We'll be back after the break.
Let's Go Green, sponsored by Airgrid, managing and operating Ireland's electricity grid for a cleaner energy future. Check out airgrid.ie for more.
You're listening to Let's Go Green here on Midlands 103, and I hope you're enjoying the show so far this week. Well, have you been to Ross Grey lately? I was notified through social media of a rather unusual and quite beautiful, in my opinion, installation that's after popping up in the Tipperary town. And it's a beautiful, beautiful image that has been put up by an artist, Dan, and who is, oh no, never mind. Sorry, Dick, bear with me one second. I just realised I've forgotten the artist's surname. I think it's Dan Leo.
Leo, yeah.
Dan Leo, isn't it?
That's great, yeah.
Okay, right. I'm gonna start that again.
No bother.
It's been a long day.
I can imagine.
You're listening to Let's Go Green here on Midlands 103, and I hope you are enjoying our show so far this week. Well, have you been to Ross Grey lately? I was notified by a post on social media of a new installation, which I've yet to see in person, but I'm looking forward to seeing in person. This absolutely stunning mural that has been created by an artist by the name of Dan Leo. And it celebrates our native species, biodiversity, but in a really modern and contemporary way. And to discuss this, we are joined by Dick Conroy from Ross Grey Tidy Towns. Dick, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you very much, Aisling. It's good to hear from you.
Now, Dick, you are most welcome to the programme and we're so delighted to have you on. But we should say we did invite the artist, Dan, but he suggested that you would be a better spokesperson on his behalf.
Yes, I feel like somebody in the firing squad.
No, not at all. I promise. I'm a nice interviewer. So, Dan, if you're listening, this is all on your behalf. But this mural, it's of a hare, a native Irish species, of course, which we see far too few of in nature these days. How did it come about? Tell us about it.
Well, I suppose it started quite some time ago. You're all familiar with the work that's been done in the likes of Waterford and in Thurles. And we've always professed that we would like something like that, particularly in the town of Ross Grey, to liven up the colours and things like that. And lo and behold, Shane Lee, a local councillor here, said there were grants available for it to be done and he would see what could be done. So he actually put us in touch with the county council and organised a meeting of the county council administrative officer, local and regional engineers, just on the Tidy Towns basis. But at that meeting, it was mooted that they would love to put up a mural for Ross Grey, but they didn't know where they could put it.
Okay.
And the job was given to us to find out where.
So there was, they were keen to get involved.
They were keen to get involved, yes.
Okay. And that's always like, you need the buy-in from the people who are going to pay for this and, you know, facilitate it all. So then, like, because from what I've seen, this mural, like, it covers the, is it the gable end of a building?
It does, yes, yeah.
It's quite large. So how did you go about identifying where in the town it was going to go and even find a property owner willing to participate?
Well, well, first of all, what we did was I went around, camera in hand or phone in hand, took several photographs of the available walls as I saw them.
And so when you say available walls, you're saying blank walls.
Blank walls that could be used. Yes, sorry.
A bit of a building needing a bit of TLC.
Yeah, we won't go down that road with the local corner now in particular. This was a fine building, actually. That was, and actually, Dan himself chose the building as being the most suitable one for the work to work on because of its stature in particular. Most of the other ones were very longitudinal and maybe narrow and not wouldn't have a great impact in the same way as this one has. So literally then after that, I had to meet the actual owner of the building, Joe Dooley. He was very amenable to the idea. But, and this is the funny thing, we just said a mural would be put up. And it just happened, he says, look, my young fella, now he calls him young fella, but he's in his 50s, okay? He's a very keen person on wildlife. And he has done actually a lot of work on Ross Grey Golf Club himself on putting up the wildlife you see there. But he says, I'd like it to be something wildlife. So that went back to the council officials and Dan eventually. And Dan came up with the design because he'd gotten the photograph of the building. And it's because the hare, you might be wondering why a hare. Mm. It's the one animal that would fit the shape of the building as it is, because the building itself is attached to another one. And a small chunk of, you know, what you would call a gable wall was missing. So the ears went up into the part above what was cut out, if you understand me. So literally, it fills the whole building, which is about 25, 30 feet high.
Okay.
You know, it's quite immense.
It is. It, even just like the photo that I saw of it, like, it's unreal. Like, it's really striking. For people who don't know Ross Gray, whereabouts in the town is this building?
Okay, if you're coming in from the Dublin side, you'll be not coming on the motorway now, but coming in what we call from the Racket Hall side, to use a phrase that everybody knows. You'll be coming into the town down what we call Church Street. And as you come down, there will be the, what you call them, the Monastery of St. Cronan is right on either side of you. You have the gable end on one side and you have the round tower on the other. As you come around that turn, you're suddenly hit in the face with the hair sitting up looking at you. It's literally there just as you come into Castle Street, right in the town. But the best way to approach it is to come from the Dublin side, or if you're coming from Burr, come in the Burr Road right across. Don't turn down the town for at the traffic lights. Go straight through. And when you come to the T-junction, take a right. And it brings you down the same road. And I guarantee you, you never saw a hair attract anybody as much. It's absolutely brilliant. Like I put up the posting. Some people took the photograph before it was finished. Dan took one just as he had finished it and put it up. But I reposted it and I got so much hits on it as to likings and God, wonderful sort of idea that they actually came along and I said, I better put up a bit more on it. So I put up the bit about the hares, affinity with the Celts and things like that, that it is a kind of, it won't say as mad as a March hare, but it's coming into March at the moment. But like that in the other story, it's such an impact. It's got over at least 500 likes, I think, at the moment on our Facebook page. It's been shared so many times, I can't keep counts of all the different likes.
Well, that's fantastic. Mm. And like, you know, Dan, like I've spoken to Dan and Dan doesn't do interviews.
Right.
So, but he has done, from what I can see, a tremendous service to the town. This is something really beautiful.
Well, it is. In no way could you not say it doesn't strike you in the face.
Yeah.
Literally. His style, you see, is such, it's, if you just drew a brown hair with the normal colourings that you'd see, it would disappear into the wall. But this has an impact, would say, because it's done kind of in block work, or you might call it, I don't know, it's not cubism or anything like that, but it's certainly done in bold colours, almost like the Book of Kells sort of writing. You know, the way they are drawing letters? That sort of style where they take chunks and they make it into something that jumps out at you.
It's a very, as you say, kind of block work, graphic style. It's really beautiful. It's really, it is, it's contemporary and it is, it's loud and in charge in the best possible way. Yeah. And it does, I think, like, I don't know when I last thought about a hare, but ever since I saw that picture, I'm thinking, God, when did I last see one? You know, like it does get us thinking about biodiversity and minding the environment around us. It starts that conversation, doesn't it?
It does. It has to, because the first question one person asked me, why a hare? And I wasn't quite able to say straight away all the different things I know now, because I've done a bit of research on it myself. But I said that was the best shape that would fit the building, because other animals were considered. And the owner of the building had to have the last vetting of it anyway. So it was decided on the hare because it would fit the building so well. But when you think about it, the hare has a kind of a history going back in Ireland, where it was almost revered as an animal long before Christian times came around. But it would serve, I think, as a brilliant, what would you call it, mascot for wildlife and biodiversity, because it's such an endemic animal in our society. Rabbits aren't in the same sort of category. The hares looked at them as being regal, you know, and although we've done over the years lots in order to, say, expand biodiversity in the town between planting hedgerows and things like that and plants and what you might call biodiversity plants, wildflower gardens and things like that. none of them have had the same impact in Ross Gray as this has. And if it starts a conversation piece, it is actually a wonderful, wonderful thing, not just from pieces of art at all, but actually from a broader spectrum, totally.
Would you recommend that other towns look at projects like these? Because, and as you say, the building that you chose in this instance, it was well-minded, and you're very grateful to the owner for being for willing to participate in the project. But,
yes, yeah.
Do you know, there are towns around the Midlands that have been through hard times in recent years and maybe have parts that are looking a bit shabby, to put it politely.
Right. Okay.
You know, that maybe that we could be a bit more creative and draw attention to biodiversity and climate change through being creative with how we're decorating these buildings.
Yeah, when you think about it, there are many buildings scattered throughout every town in Ireland that are unoccupied, possibly heading for dereliction, but could be brought back to life with a coat of paint. And if you put something artistic, like I've seen it several places, if you go into Limerick and other places going through, where they've actually just done the windows and drawn, say, as if somebody was sitting behind them in a bowl of flowers or whatever. Something like that would brighten up everywhere that is dull looking at the moment. And it might encourage a lot of people to think more about planting a few flowers in the garden or having a window box or whatever. But it will certainly, I think, create a better diversity-friendly townscape, because all our towns are 90% concrete and asphalt and whatever else. And you don't see too many wildlife outside of two-legged ones on a Saturday night coming around the place. But literally, I think it would be a brilliant idea if people or organizations or groups took on board one building. You're not going to try and do the whole town. It's impossible. But if you took on one building, and they did this year, and took on another and maybe done something with it the following year, and don't repeat everything exactly the same. Remember, biodiversity is the name of the game. Be different, no matter what you do. And use a bit of imagination and you'll bring your townscape back to life, and maybe you'll also enhance the biodiversity by your planting. We say nearby it happened a window box or something, because maybe a next door neighbour might put up a window box because they don't want their place to be outshone by this building here. You know, I'm just thinking outside the box, but and I don't want to insult anybody either. So.
No. You know, Dick, you're an absolute tonic. Thank you so much for joining me on this week's Let's Go Green. For people who are around the Midlands, do go to Ross Gray, take a look at this massive hair by the artist Dan Leo. I suspect it's going to be the favourite selfie spot in Ross Gray Town Centre.
Definitely, yeah. It's heading there, yeah.
I will be sure to check it out myself when I'm next in Ross Gray. But for now, Dick, thank you so much for joining us on Let's Go Green.
Thank you ever so much, Aisling. It's great talking to you.
We'll be back after the break.
Let's Go Green, sponsored by Airgrid, managing and operating Ireland's electricity grid for a cleaner energy future. Check out airgrid.ie for more.
You're listening to Let's Go Green here on Midlands 103. And I hope you enjoyed all of our speakers on the show this week. I thoroughly enjoyed those conversations. And I do hope to get to Ross Gray in the near future to see that amazing mural in person. Just looking at all the various images of it online, it really looks fantastic. If you are interested in getting involved in the show, remember you can put yourself, your community group, your workplace, whomever you like even, forward. Please do feel free to get in contact with me directly. You can do so on the Midlands 103 website. So midlands103.com. There's a button at the top of the screen, the on-air team. Scroll down and you'll see my face and my name, Aisling O'Rourke. Just click on the button there and send me an email from that page. Otherwise, you can get in contact with me through LinkedIn. I'm Aisling O'Rourke CC, or on Instagram, I am at The Communications Coach. So you can send me a message there if you'd like to get involved in the show. I'm really interested in those of you that are involved in community groups that are working on projects in your community with the aim of doing something positive for the environment and the community at the same time. So if that's you, please do get in contact with me. Remember, if you would like to apply for any funding around any of these groups, it is important to keep an eye out for these funding calls. There's an awful lot of funding opportunities actually at the moment, and the application process is open for quite a number at the moment. So I think your best port of call on that would be the local heritage officer for your county council. Give them a call, ask, can they help you with that? So you've got the heritage officer, you've also got your community climate action officer in many of the county councils. And now we also have biodiversity officers for the majority, or nearly the majority of county councils right around the country. So if there's a project that you're working on in your community and you know you'll need funding to get it off the ground and you might be eligible for any of these call outs, it's really worth your time booking an appointment with the experts in the local authority to talk you through the application process, which fund you may or may not be eligible for. It's worth your while finding out the details and just really getting some advice with the application process, because, like, you know, there is a skill to applying for a grant. There's definitely a skill to it, and understanding really what's required and what those who design these forms are really and truly looking for. So it's worth your while getting a bit of advice on it. And we'll be discussing a new call out for funds from the Heritage Council on next week's show. I'm afraid that is all we have time for on this week's episode of Let's Go Green. Please do remember that each and every episode of the show is available on Midlands103.com. If you click on the podcast page for Let's Go Green, you'll get all our back episodes there. And of course, we're on Spotify and Apple Podcasts as well. So if you missed anything, please do listen back there. And as I said, feel free to get in contact with me. I love getting all your messages and I do read them all. As I said before, sometimes I'm not the fastest at responding to emails, but I do promise I do read them all and I appreciate the kind messages. However, I have to say goodbye for now, and I'll be back same time next week with another episode of Let's Go Green. Have a great week and stay safe.
Let's Go Green, sponsored by Airgrid, managing and operating Ireland's electricity grid for a cleaner energy future. Check out airgrid.ie for more.